You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Five minutes after 8 o'clock on a Thursday, the last Thursday before Thanksgiving. And joining me from Southern California is James Sanchez from Garfield High School in East Los Angeles. What is up, Marine? How are you?
What's going on, sir? Just here trying to do my morning workout and dropping off my kids to school.
All right. Yeah. So, first of all, before we talk about you and your Marine Corps career, tell everybody what you're doing now. When did you get out of the Marine Corps?
You know, it's been almost 2 years now, sir. You know, I took a whole year off, just kind of didn't do too much. I started going to school. So I've been in school now about 3 years, still enjoying my retirement. Going to LAPD. That's what I'm trying to accomplish now. Going through the process, and hopefully here by the beginning of the year, I should be in the academy and trying to pursue law enforcement.
All right. And where are you living?
I live in Murrieta, California, over here by. Not a lot of people know about this area, but it's close to Fallbrook, which Fallbrook is real close to Camp Pendleton.
Right.
So most of us. Half of the command that we're used to being with live here.
The if you go out the back gate at Camp Pendleton through the ammunition, the naval, the magazine out the back gate. You go to Fallbrook, which isn't too far from Escondido, and then if you go north from there, a lot of Marines live in the Temecula Murrieta area because the housing's pretty affordable, and taking their GI Bill, they could nice homes too, nice big homes, and beautiful area. So you don't be causing any nonsense up there, because you're gonna get a lot of people that will come out of their homes and deal with you. So if you're gonna cause some nonsense, I would tell you do it someplace other than Murrieta and Temecula. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's just a lot of Marines out here, law enforcement, a lot of professional people. So it's a good environment to raise kids. Schools are great here. Crime is very low. So it's an ideal place to raise your kids. And you know, now that I'm retired, I enjoy the peace and quiet.
Oh, you don't like the nightlife anymore. You don't. You kind of take it easy now, low key.
Low key, those things came and went for me. I left a lot of that stuff in Okinawa.
All right, let's first of all, let's talk about Cesar Sanchez and I met in Fallujah in 2006. We were both working for the 5th Marine Regiment, and we used to work side by side every night for about 12-13 hours doing stuff, trying to help kill bad people and help save good people most nights. So pretty interesting job that we had. And but I want to before we talk about any of that stuff, people have to meet you to know if we can believe you or not. So so born and raised where?
I was born and raised in LA, East LA, and I actually went to Roosevelt High. Garfield was our rival school.
Why do I think that you went to Garfield? Why does that stay in my head?
I think because we have a big game every year that we play against these guys, and it's one of the biggest high school rivals. And people still go from like the 1940s and 50s and 60s that played football in that field. And I think I probably told you that. I think Garfield's kind of stuck in there.
The all right, so went to Roosevelt High School, and talk about your family, brothers, sisters. What did you have growing up?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. My dad met my mom probably in the 70s, and you know they kind of split up. So I ended up going to my grandma's house, and pretty much my grandma raised me. My dad was a single guy, so you know he kind of went on with life, and I kind of ended up staying with my grandma and my aunt, and I end up living with them until I joined the Marine Corps. So that was the people that raised me.
All right, you and I were talking one night, and just so people get some sense of and this is one of the cool things about the Marine Corps is it is a melting pot, right? I'm a white upper middle class kid that grew up in Sacramento, California. Cesar Sanchez, a Hispanic man from being raised by his grandma in East L.A. And then you all, you know, you're all thrown together and you learn from each other. So one night he's telling a story about one of the Marines asked why he started lifting weights. And and he tells a story about his brother who so tell the story. And so you hear it and you're like, holy smokes. I mean, what a world to grow up in, because the story, and he can tell it, but the story goes that, you know, his brother says, look, when you go to prison, right? And you're sitting there listening to it and you're like, you gotta be kidding me. I mean, that's the world. And now he's going to go work for the LAPD. You gotta be kidding me, right? So tell that story. Tell the story about your brother, talking to you.
Well, my brother, you know, we grew up in the projects, some place called Aliso Village. And it's probably a mile away from downtown. It's on First Street in Mission in L.A. And I think the biggest way to explain this is that there's a lot of tough kids that kind of grow in that environment. Most of the kids end up joining gangs. Once you join gangs, you're more prone to go to prison and live that type of life. You know, when these guys get out of jail, they're like heroes. And all the young guys kind of emulate them. And going to prison, it's almost kind of like graduating from university. There's some excitement on that because they made it through. So my brother kind of came up to me and said, hey, you look like a little guy. And you better start doing some push-ups. Because when you go in there, you have to fend for yourself, and you have to be, you know, you're either a victim or you're the guy that takes care of business. So he told me some story how certain guys get, you know, abused in there. And, you know, I jumped up and I said, oh, no, that's not going to be me. So that day I started doing push-ups and lifting heavy weights. And that's why I started lifting. And it helped me through my sports and football and everything else. But that was the whole reason behind it. It was not to get fit. It was not the mentality to get fit. It was to defend myself, which it kind of worked out at the end. But because of the Marine Corps, you know, we try to stay fit and whatnot. But that was the mentality back then. That was the reason that I started working out.
That you started working out. Talk just about the influence of your mom, because you grew up in that, of your grandma. You grew up, and tell the story about your grandma coming down to the park in like her, and yelling at you to get away from your friends. What did she call them, hoodlums?
Yeah, see, my grandma was always,
this is awesome.
My grandma would, you know, when you live in that environment, you have feeling friends, because that's your environment. That's what, you know, that's what happens there.
Right.
You know, and there's still good people that come out of there. There's people that I still talk to that turned their life around. They didn't go to the military, but, they end up, you know, going to, some of them even end up joining the city council.
Wow.
In LA, and, they did good stuff. But in general, most of those guys, they go to prison, they come out, and it's the same story every year. And I see
some of those guys once in a while, here and there, and they're still looking for jobs, you know, in our 40s. So those are the guys that my grandma would like to push away from me. And at the time, I didn't understand. So
right, they're just your friends, right?
Right, they're just my friends to play basketball with or stuff like that. So, but thank God that I kind of listened to her, because she would tell me, you know, hey, whoever you hang out with, that's who you're going to become. And at the time, I didn't understand until the light bulb went on years later, and I understood that if you hang around with guys that don't care about their lives, and I don't care about yours either. So I started seeing those things, and I started learning. And my grandma was just one of those ladies that would come wherever I'm at and would tell me to come home. And, you know, I go through some embarrassing moments. And, you know, she would just say, hey, what are you doing with all these losers and thugs? And I'd be like, oh, my God, you know, what are you doing, Grandma? You know, you're lucky you're my grandma, because they're going to roll you up.
Now, the best part of this is you can imagine, you know, Cesar Sanchez at the park playing basketball with his friends, right? And his grandma rolls down and starts yelling at him in front of his friends. He's like, oh, man, come on, Grandma, you got to stop this. And he tells you, like, it's hoodlums, and your friends are looking at you like, who's she talking about, us?
Exactly. And, my grandma one day couldn't find me. I was in the basketball area playing basketball. Calls my dad. I haven't seen my dad in years. My dad shows up, and I haven't seen him in years, so I'm like, wow, that's my dad. This guy punches me right in the mouth, and my friends take out their guns. And I'm like, no, fellas, this is my dad. So that's the type of kind of life that I grew up with all these guys. So they were there. I mean, they all kind of influenced me also not to do the wrong thing.
All right, let's talk about that, because you become a pretty good football player, right?
Right.
Right. And in a few minutes, you're going to tell the story about your recruiting visit to San Diego State when they told him that he would redshirt because they had this guy named Marshall Faulk that was playing tailback. And the response was, who? Who is that? Why? what does that guy have on me? What's up with that? Anyway, so you're a good football player at Roosevelt, and you're walking home, and somebody you get shot at, right?
Yeah, we lived in an area where we had to walk through so many gang infested neighborhoods. And if you don't even have to be from a certain area, a gang, but if you're from that area, they presume you're from that gang. So they knew that I lived in the projects, and they lived another 5 blocks away from us. And, you know, I mean, I was the only one with my football pads going home, and there goes that guy from that area. So, you know, every day was who's next? Who I got to fight next? So I fought a lot of guys.
All right. So now I want you to tell the story about getting shot at and then getting chased, and you fighting three guys, and then your brother showing up. I just want people to Cesar Sanchez's story is a bit of a miracle, and so I'm gonna, because he and I know each other, I'm gonna drag him through this shit. All right. And whether he wants to tell it or not, he's gonna tell it. What a miracle it is that he is where he is today, and all the different confrontations that he's faced in his life, which to me are just an awesome statement about him, and in particular about his grandma. Tell the story about getting chased and then your brother showing up.
Well, it was another day coming from football practice, and there was this other gang that one of them, I guess they kind of ambushed me, right? And I had my, in those days we had the Walkmans. So I had a tape on, trying to walk I'm, you know, about halfway through my home. Some guy pops out of the bush. And to be honest, I still didn't even know what was going on. Somebody taps me in my back. And I kind of turn around. You know, keep in mind, I still have my earphones on. And I get punched right in the jaw, right? So I'm like, what's going on? So my first reaction is I stop fighting. So I'm getting the best of this guy. You know, I've always been a big kid, and I was always fit. So, I'm having a good time. And then another guy comes out of nowhere. So he's trying to hold me. So I get both of them in the ground. Then another guy comes, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, now he's getting it. This ain't my movie, you know. This ain't a Bruce Lee movie, you know. I think I better run. So one of them is holding my feet so I don't have to run. And I'm getting the other one. And at that moment, my older brother comes out of nowhere with his buddies, and my older brother, he wasn't down. So he always had a crew with him. When we were kids, he already been in the gangs for a long time. So he was an older guy, which we call the veteran. So he comes out, you know, and I've had enough, you know, the guys are there. One of the guys kind of mouths out to my brother. My brother pistol whips him and tells him to be quiet. This is going to be a one-on-one now. And I already hurt the guy, and my brother tells me, he goes, nope. They would have killed you, so you better handle it. And I was feeling kind of like, okay, well, I already did what I did. So he had a broken cast, the guy that hit me. So he tells me to keep fighting him, and then, so I do. I feel kind of pressure because, you know, that was not really my life. I felt like, you know, we put him up, and it was, you know.
Right.
So all of a sudden, he tells me, hey, stomping his arm. Why don't you break his arm again? And I was like, no way, man. This is crazy. This is beyond, right? This is reckless to me.
Right.
But I had some pressure that I felt, you know what, you're right. This guy, they would have done probably worse to me. So I went ahead and kicked him in his arm and broke his arm again. But, you know, even years after, I felt pretty bad about that because that was kind of, in my eyes, it was cruel. I took my punches, he took his, and it should have been it.
Right.
But I kind of learned two lessons. You know, a lot of these guys that are very hardcore gang members, they don't care. They'll do that to you and your family with no remorse. The difference for me is that I had some remorse, even though he kind of sucked a punch me. I had some remorse. I just knew that life wasn't for me. I didn't sit right with me.
But what I want people to understand is the pressure. You know, here's your older brother, right? He's your older brother. Right, and he's in gangs, and now, you know, this thing happens, and the first thing he tells you though is to kick the guy's teeth out, right? Kick all his teeth out, and you said,
yeah.
He said, no, I don't want to do that. So you so you see this clash of, you know, James being raised by his grandmother, right, being told you don't want to do this, you don't want to do this, and truth be told, probably not in James's heart, right. And then, but you're not going to be a punk to your older brother, right? You got to man up.
It's the environment. It's the environment you live in, and you can't show too much weakness because if you do, they'll see that a mile away, and they'll kind of use that, and they'll keep picking on you, or they'll try to kind of guide you to do wrong. So you have to kind of stand up for yourself. In that environment, if you don't, then you won't survive. You just won't. You won't be able to function in that environment and be respected. So they'll always think you're a pushover, and then they'll just attack you. So when you fight, and they know that you're a big kid and this and that, you go through. You know, it takes one good fight, and then you're good for the next couple of years. You know, so. That's how it kind of works. You just have to do certain things to survive.
Right, right. But again, you're... So James is, like, filled with these, you know, trying to do the right thing, right? His grandma, and yet also having older brothers that, that are trying to steer him in a way that they think is going to help him survive in this world that he lives in. And talk about meeting your wife, and then I want you to talk about one night you told me a story about fighting your way out of your gang, and then going to be recruited in San Diego, and then we'll talk about how you get to the Marine Corps. But talk about meeting your wife. You met your wife when you were how old?
I met my wife when I was turning 18 years old. I was like 17, and my grandma passed away. My grandma passed away, and my aunt left to Central America. So, you know, I was kind of on my own. We still had a place in the projects, but I was pretty much on my own. So my dad, that I hadn't seen really for years, came into the picture. He said, "Hey, you can come and live with me." And he lived in Chino, California, which it was pretty boring. You know, it was kind of a middle-class neighborhood. I was just used to that. It was not loud enough. so I couldn't commute back and forth to Roosevelt to keep playing football. So I end up going to that school for my last semester to Don Lugo. And I end up meeting my wife there. You know, I'm the new kid in town. So I'm dating all the girls. I'm popular kid coming from one of those schools to kind of a slower school.
Right.
In the sense of, you know, it's not like the big cities.
Right, right. So you're the new tough guy.
Exactly. You know, nice. None of those kids intimidated me. You know, there was like little wannabe gangs there. And so it just didn't intimidate me or anything. So they just took me in, and I'm that tough guy. So I met my wife, you know. I was going to go buy a cooking milk. You know, I've always liked cooking milk. And I guess this girl has liked me for a semester. I didn't even know about this. One of my buddies told me, "Hey, this girl likes you." So I turned around, and I still remember what my wife was wearing. Yeah, she was wearing some tight Levi's, you know, looking real good. So I said, "Sure." I went up to her, and gave me her number, and the next day I went to see her. I stood on her porch, and I never left. I'm still with her.
I never left. So you meet her, and she's how old? 16, and you're 18. How old is she?
As a matter of fact, you know, I thought that she was a senior. So I'm thinking she's a senior, and in one of those conversations, I said, "Hey, are you going to senior, you know, to the practice for graduation?" And she tells me, "No, I'm not a senior. You know, I'm a freshman." I said, "A freshman? Really?
What?"
Yeah, she was like, when I met her, she was 15 years old.
Oh my God!
I was 17. I'm about to turn 18. And she's 15 years old. I mean, I guess their school, they start like the year before what I'm used to in our school. So, in reality, I never compute. I just thought, you know, we're both in high school. I mean, okay. And then she became my girlfriend. And then, you know, I already had plans to join the Marine Corps. So one day I go to her house and I try to break up with her. I tell her, "Hey, you know, I'm going to the Marine Corps. And to be honest, I don't know where they're going to send me. So I think it should end. And, you know, you don't have a good life, you know." But she was adamant to say, no, I don't want to hear that. "You're going to go to boot camp. I'll write to you." And I said, "Okay, you know, I've had a lot of girlfriends. It's gonna die out."
Right.
So I went to boot camp with the mindset of, you know, I'm just go to boot camp, finish my boot camp, and move on in life. But she kept writing to me through boot camp, and you know, I was I was like, okay, if she makes it through second phase, then she'd be all right. She was still there for third phase, so I was like, wow. All of a sudden, she's going to family day, and I was okay. Well, if she makes it to my graduation, then I guess we should date. So that's how it kind of went. We dated for another 2 years, and then I don't know how I even think about this, but we talk about having kids. And she's like, I don't know, at that point, she's probably like 16 and a half, maybe,
holy
17 years old. And we decided to have a baby. We talked about this. So it was not like a mistake. We talked about it and this and that. And all of a sudden, you know, she tells me, hey, you know, I'm pregnant.
Wait, and, so, and so now you're what, 19 or 20, and she's 17?
I think I'm about 19 years old.
Okay.
And,
all right.
I'm on my first duty station, and she tells me, yeah, I'm pregnant. And so it goes back to when she tells me she's pregnant, it was another turn in my life, because all the people in my family, all the guys have left all the girls. They have kids from everywhere,
right.
You know, many, many females. And I was a product of one of those, right? I mean, they left me at my grandma's house with a lot of other cousins there. So I knew then that I was not going to do that to my son. So I tell her, hey, we got to do it right. So, you know, I go over there by Santa Monica. I go to his nice restaurant and at the end of the Santa Monica Pier.
Right.
And I get some mariachis that are in there. I tell him, hey, I'm going to ask my girl to marry me. I had bought a ring already. So I ask her, hey, you want to be my wife and we're not? And she said yes. And, you know, we made a date. So this is the funny thing. I'm in 29 Palms. And in those days, you know, Marines, there's not a lot of married Marines, first of all.
No, not then.
There's not a lot of cars in those days. I mean, maybe one guy has a car. So I tell my platoon sergeant, I say, hey, I'm going to get married. So he says, well, you have duty this weekend. You can't get married. So I said, Staff Sergeant, I'm going to get married. So I'm already thinking, okay, I guess I got to go UA for a day. I got to marry her and come back and face the consequences, right?
Right.
So my Staff Sergeant tells me, I guess he thought I was going to do that. So he tells me, hey, you have one day to get married, and you better be back because you have duty on Sunday. So I rush to Vegas. I marry my wife. I get up in the morning. I say, I got to go back. I got duty. So that's how it works, you know. I mean, I was grateful that they let me go for that one day. Got married. It kind of sucked. I told my wife, I got to go, you know. And I put up for my duty and, you know, kind of sucked. But nevertheless, we got married and everything worked out. And,
No, you know, when he told his story, I looked at him and I said, do you know what the odds are that you're still married when you get married that young in the Marine Corps, you know, with all the separation? I mean, the odds are like nobody stays, or not nobody, but I mean, it's a very small percentage of Marines. And you know this, right? You know this.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You know how rare your family is in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, that I think it's, you know, we for a long time, you know, the deployment we went to, it was a year long deployment.
Right.
But then that 1 year, you know, there was a lot of divorces.
Right.
And it just happened to be that, you know, we both have good families and they were supportive. When I wasn't there, they were there.
Right.
And I think she was able to surpass, a lot of the stuff that we do.
Right. That's why your story is such a cool story. Talk about the recruiting trip to San Diego State. That's funny.
Oh, the recruit. well, you know, I wanted to play for USC. I was playing fullback at the time and running back, and I was a big kid, So they didn't think I could run that fast. But then they figured out this guy's big, but he could still run. So I did good. I, you know, but the only school that recruited me at the time was, you know, San Diego State. And I was like, who's San Diego State? I don't even know who you guys are. You know, I've grown up with USC here. You know, I said, okay, I guess I'll show up, you know. So I had like a little meet and greet. So I went there, you know, I'm thinking I'm the best guy in LA, you know, and, you know, we've gone to so many competitions in South Central. So, you know, so I show up, you know, and I look at the football field. They show me all this stuff and I'm like, okay, well, I'll be ready to play next year. You know, I'm ready to go. And they tell me, no, I don't think so. I think you're going to, you know, you're going to have to practice. You're going to be a redshirt. I'm a redshirt. What's a redshirt? You know, I'm the best guy in my neighborhood. What do you mean? You know, and at the time it was Marshall Faulk. I wanted to take over his, position. And I'm like, I don't know this guy, man. I didn't know who Marshall Faulk was. You know, he got drafted, I think, one or two in
the NFL Hall of Fame.
Like, I ain't playing under this guy. Man, I don't know this guy. You know, I'm so I said, you know what? I'm going to show you guys. I ain't playing for you guys. So I go to the recruiting to join the Marine Corps, you know, and I never looked back. I joined the Marine Corps. I showed them. You know, many years later, I figured it out. I know. I think they showed me, right?
it worked out. No, that's a funny story. My guest is Staff Sergeant James Sanchez, born and raised in East LA, retired 2 years ago, from the Marine Corps, an infantryman by trade, and he and I worked together in Fallujah in 2006. And we're going to talk about his transition here in a few minutes, but wanted everybody to get to know him. His story is an awesome story, of his devotion to his family. And, the other story I wanted you to tell is we would be we're working, and because of the time change, you know, he was working when his kids would be awake, and so he'd call home from, you know, we were working at nights, and so he'd call home, and so he's sitting next to me, and I can hear him say, "You want to speak Spanish with Daddy?" And then I hear him say, "What do you mean, no?" And then he'd get off the phone, right? And it's like every dad gets off the phone, like when their kids, like, you know, do stupid stuff or whatever. And they look at you like, you know what my kid did? And he looks at me and he goes, "What kind of kids don't want to speak Spanish, for God's sakes?" And so he would get off the phone and he'd say, "God damn it." And he'd say, "What's wrong?" He said, "Well, my wife's family doesn't speak Spanish like my family does. And my kids are like, my wife's Hispanic, I'm Hispanic. My kids don't want to speak. They don't want to speak Spanish. Like, what the hell?" So now, have you ever rectified that? I mean, I know when you got home, like, you know, the Spanish got spoken, but that's a funny story.
You know, my wife. You know, when my wife met me, the first time I talked in, this is at school, right?
Right.
She told me years later, "When you talked to me, your accent was so deep, I thought you were from Mexico." What do you mean? I was born here, right? So, you know, I grew up, my first language was Spanish. And then you learn English at school with your friends and whatnot. And you know, so you never know you have an accent. I don't even have an accent now, but apparently I do. So, my wife is, you know, she's like 6th, 7th generation here, but she is also half white and half Mexican. But through those 7 generations, all they speak is English. So my wife actually doesn't speak Spanish. She understands me. You know, it's almost like I'm Ricky Ricardo, right, with Lucy. So I talk to her in Spanish sometimes. She kind of understands me through so many years of being together.
Right.
Because we're gone all the time, she speaks nothing but English. to my kids. So when I tell them something in Spanish, they look at me like, what? What are you talking about? I don't know what you're saying. So I used to get real frustrated. I'd be like, come on, man, you're Hispanic. You're Sanchez, right? I mean, you need to speak Spanish. But, you know, they go to school here, you know, they talk English. So it's a uphill battle. The funny thing is that my kids now take Spanish in high school. Right? They're straight A students. But I come to the house and I speak Spanish and they don't understand still, right? I'm like, how are you a straight A student in Spanish and don't understand what I'm talking about?
Oh, my God. Now, you know what? It is, though. It's the way, it's the melting pot of the United States, right? So when you come to the country, you know, you're steeped in your tradition of your native land and your language. Your kids have a foot in both worlds. They go to school and speak English. Their friends speak English, right? And they come home and they speak the native tongue. And then, you know, but they want to wear, like, I see kids around here where I live. They're Vietnamese. They're Hispanic. There is nothing Vietnamese or Hispanic about them. They got their phone, right? And the little headset on. They've got their long, you know, the long shorts on. They're skateboarding. Right, they got their Billabong shirt on. I'm like, that is American, okay? Like, I don't know where you come from. Then I see the nannies around here that are mostly Hispanic, and they're taking kids for walks in their yoga pants, okay? Right? Right? You're like, this is American. This is, and that's the beauty of the melting pot. But it used to be funny. He'd get off the phone and he'd just look at me. God damn it. And I would sit there and laugh. You joined the Marine Corps. How do you, did you join the Marine Corps open contract? How do you become a grunt?
You know, there's a little story behind that. I went to, I thought everything was in the Army, really. I didn't even know the Marine Corps existed. So, you know, I had a mentor down the street. He was an LAPD officer. And he was on anchor. I didn't know what that was. I thought it was like a bird, and I used to think, who puts a bird as a tattoo, right? And he will always kind of put the Marine Corps on me. He's like, hey, man, you got to join the Marine Corps and, you know, stop hanging around with these losers. But for whatever reason, I kind of knew it was either prison or you go to the military. There was no room for college. In the sense of money, where I was just going to go pay my way in. So I had to get a scholarship, or there was no college for me. And, you know, I showed San Diego State that I wasn't going to be a redshirt, so that was that. So I go to the Army recruiting office, and this guy comes up, you know, and I wasn't impressed. He looked like a bag of chips, and you know, he was late. He was late to our appointment. And even then, even in those days, I knew about 15 minutes prior. So, you know, he didn't even show up. So I kind of go to the curb and I'm just kind of kicking rocks. And this guy comes in and has really shiny shoes, right? That's the first thing I noticed. And he was in his blues. And I'm like, man, this guy looks sharp. I said, what are you guys? And he's like, hey, we're the Marine Corps. I said, okay, I signed up. I came to sign up today. You know what? Keep in mind, you know, I'm pretty much homeless. I moved to my dad's house for about 6 months, but he had his life already going with his wife or whatnot. I have a half brother. You know, I'm sleeping in the couch. So, you know, me and my dad's never been really close, never been really a part of my life. So I pretty much felt homeless. And luckily I met my girlfriend, then asked my wife, because I spent a lot of time with her. Eating with her family, and you know, I even slept in the couch a couple of times, you know. So, so that's why I ended up joining. I go in there and they show me this old video in the early 90s about like recon, and it looked pretty exciting, man. It looked, I could do that. I think I could do that. So when I came out of that room and said, hey, so you know what you want to do? I said, yeah, I want to do what that video is doing. You know, it looks pretty exciting to me. So they said, oh, so you want to be 03? I said, sign me up. So he signed me up. I was over 18, so they gave me a shipping day, and I was like, okay, well, I'm ready to roll. So they, my recruiter went to pick me up in the projects, which he was a little scared because there was, you know, gang members around where I lived, and they were like, "Who is this guy?" You know, they thought he was a cop or something. So I'm like, "Oh man, he's all right, man. He's my recruiter." And I remember my aunt, the one that raised me. You know, they came real early in the morning. They picked me up, and my aunt said goodbye to me, and that was that. And then I left the projects. I turned around, and that was it. And I joined, and, you know, many doors opened for me along the way. So yeah, I just kept staying in. You know, I never thought I was going to do 20 years. I thought people were crazy doing 20 years. You know, it was too long for me. You know, I get to 29 Palms, and I'm thinking I'm going to be here for 4 years. I cannot believe it. There was nothing there in the early 90s. It was dirt. I just couldn't understand who would come here. But, you know, through time I got used to it and it kind of worked out 20 years later. And, you know, I had a colonel. I'm sure you know him. He was a lieutenant colonel at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Tulin.
I know him, yeah.
He's a general now.
He retired as a lieutenant general, 3-star.
I'm at Edson Range, and I want to join the LAPD. This is like the late 90s, and my time is coming up. I'm already done. You know, I'm checking out, and he tells me, "No, I'm going to give you a 30-day extension there, Sergeant." I said, "Sir, I'm done. I'm trying to get to LAPD. I'm trying to get on with my life." He said, "Look, I'm going to give you a 30-day extension. I don't want to hear no more shit." That's it. So I thought about it. Well, two more paychecks, I guess. I might as well do it. And then LAPD told me, "You know what? You can't even start. It's going to take a long time. It's a process. It would take up to a year." And I'm like, "A year? I'm married. What am I going to do, you know?" You know, I'm thinking, am I going to work at Horchata's Warehouse? Where am I going, you know? I have a family. You know, and I come back to his office. I said, "All right, sir, I'm ready to roll." He tells me, "Hey, I'm going to give you another 30-day extension. I want you to think about it, about re-enlistment." I said, "Sir, I thought about it many times, and I think this is it." He goes, "Well, I don't care. Here's 30 more days." So I'm thinking, well, two more paychecks, you know. So the third time I show up, another 30 days later, he tells me, "Hey, Sergeant, look, I got you a good gig. You have to reenlist. I can't pull no more strings, but you could go to Florida, Norfolk, Virginia. You're going to be, you know, security forces. Take your family out there. Have a good time." I said, "Sir." He said, "I don't want to hear your shit." "Fuck, man. You better reenlist." I said, "I ain't scared of you, sir." You know, I'm on my way out.
Hey, you know what, sir? And General Tulin, he's a big dude, too.
He's a big guy, you know.
Yeah, he's
He cares for us, you know. He showed a lot of love to the enlisted side, to the young Marines.
Right.
So I said, "Okay, sir, I need to reenlist, like, right now. Because if you can't do it right now, then I ain't going to do it." So he calls all his people, all the Marines, you know, and I didn't get along with the first one at the time. So he goes, who you want here? I said, "You know what? I want First Sergeant Cook and this warrant officer here that I kind of don't get along with. I want them to see when I reenlist." He said, okay, so I'm saying today, call First Sergeant and call this person. So, you know, so I reenlist, and he gives me a moment to say whatever I want to say. "You can say whatever you want to say."
Uh-oh.
I said, "No, you guys don't want to hear. You guys don't want to hear what I want to say." I said, "Thank you, sir." And I went home. My wife is telling me, "So are you getting out?" "No, you enlisted." "And we're going to Norfolk, Virginia." So every time, so I reenlisted. It was the best thing I did. I went to security forces. I ended up training DOD police. Met a lot of great people. I ended up picking up Staff Sergeant over there. It was a great time.
So every time I see him now, I think of him. I think that I was able to retire and still be in Marine because of one officer. And I don't know what it was. He kept insisting and just ultimately he talked me into it. And I'm grateful. You know, retirement. You know, we don't become Marines to be rich, but we live a little bit better than the average person.
Right. No, and you live a lot better once you get a full time job, right?
Right. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, once I retired, it's like I won the lottery.
Yeah, you'll be sending me money. especially because LAPD, they make a lot of money. So what battalion was that? 1-7?
What, say that again?
When Lieutenant Colonel Tulin was your battalion CO, what battalion was it?
No, we were at Edson Range at the time.
Oh, he was at Edson Range.
He was at Edson Range, and then he left. I think he went to 5th Marines.
Right.
Wow. And we never really... I think we crossed paths one time, and he remembered me, and
I'm going to talk to him pretty soon, and I will. Oh, yeah. And I'll mention that to him.
He'll remember, but I thought it was cool, you know. It was a turning point, another turning point in my life.
Well, he likes tough guys. He likes tough guys. Yeah. He's a boxer. Right? I mean, he's a big guy and he's a boxer and he likes tough guys. And when you're around Cesar Sanchez, he either says it either right before he's getting ready to fight somebody or he says it as a compliment, and that is the word tough guy. If he says, oh, tough guy, that means there's a 50-50 chance there's going to be a fight like within a few moments, okay? And, or if he, you know, if he sees you and he looks at you and he says, hey, you're a tough guy, that's a compliment. So,
right before I retired, I saw, well, he's another general now, General Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
I was in, Camp Margarita. I was one of the guys in charge there. He said something. He looked at me. He said, you know, Staff Sergeant Sanchez, right? I said, yes, sir. Yeah, 5th Marines. Working at where we were working at in the COC, you know, there was a couple nights that I was, you know, he was a colonel at that point, but
right.
I would go into his office and he told me the story when he got hit, you know, in Fallujah and, you know, the rocket came in through that little window,
right.
And ended up killing, you know, a few Marines. Probably, I think it was like the XO or somebody, but,
the Camo.
Yeah. So I had like some personal one-on-one, which, you know, sometimes that doesn't really happen to enlisted.
Right.
You know, I always liked General Nicholson. I think because he was kind of real with the Marines. He wasn't BS. He didn't BS us. He said what he had to say, and he would be able to motivate us to go out there and do that, especially the guys that went out the wire every day.
Right.
I was some of those kids were my recruits in boot camp. So, you know, I had another connection with them, but from everybody I've heard from even those days, it was good. He was a good leader.
No, he and Tulin are very similar in that they're ordinary guys too. They're ordinary guys. They like athletes. They like to compete. They're tough guys, and
right.
they're very similar guys. You know what? You may have to come back because we're going to run out of time. But I've got a couple email questions for you. Here's one. Mac, was Staff Sergeant Sanchez ever a hat? And what are his thoughts on some of the stuff coming out of Paris Island? So you were a drill. Tell everybody about you were a drill instructor for how many years?
No, actually, I wasn't a drill instructor. I was a PMI.
Okay.
But I met a lot of. A lot of drill instructors at the time there, because that was a great PMI, so the drill instructors will you know, they will call me and, you know, tell me, hey, I'm not the best instructor for my platoon, which, in those days, we used to go to, squad bays and peaks. This was like extra curriculum, but I always did that because it kind of improved my success in the, you know, in the,
once we went out there in the range and fired or whatnot. So I ended up building a good reputation with them, that even in Fallujah, there was a little moment where there was a lot of drill instructors, prior drill instructors, where they thought I was a drill instructor. I said, no, nah, I'm a PMI, you know? And they're like, not today, man. We're going to make you an honorable drill instructor. I said, all right, man. So there's a lot of drill instructors that later, I guess because I was everywhere at Etchem, they figure I was a hat.
Right. All right, well, talk to me. You've read about this stuff, you know, and Gunnery Sergeant just got reduced to a private, you know, calling a young Muslim recruit a terrorist and some of the other stuff. Your thoughts on all that?
You know, there's a level of as a status CO, I think there's a level of I don't want to say hazing, you know, because hazing has a bad connotation of that, you know, we're going to break them or we're going to hit them. And I think that's abuse.
Right.
There's certain things that we do, maybe push-ups and pull-ups and stuff like that. I think when we cross the line on talking about people's religion or their race, or they're too short or chubby or skinny, I think that's not our job as instructors. I think we got to kind of stick with the curriculum, but they're coming to the big brothers. And one thing in my life that I've learned is that I learn more by, if I respect you, I will learn from you. If I don't respect you, it goes in one ear, it comes out the other. So I think to be successful in the long run for the Marine Corps, I think we have to respect these kids in the sense of trying to show how we think, our personal views on stuff, you know. To me, that was wrong. I read the article, how some of these drill instructors, you know, they were telling the other recruits, you know, hey, you have to pretend like you're cutting his head or whatnot.
Right, that's crazy stuff to me. And so let me ask you a follow-up then. Why wouldn't another NCO or staff NCO look at him and say, Gunny, knock it off, man? Because if they do that, he's not in jail now. He's got four daughters and a wife. He's now a private. He's going to Leavenworth. He's going to Brig for 10 years or at least some part of 10 years. And his life's ruined. Why do you think more? I mean, because I could it's kind of interesting in this job and looking at different things. You and I were both in Fallujah when the incident with 3-5 happened where they drug a guy out of his home and they killed
right.
him. Right. In fact, we were part of getting the guy's body out of the ground and shipped back to Dover so they could do the autopsy and stuff like that. The so that's one incident. The urination incident in Afghanistan is still in the news today. It was just in the news because charges got dropped on a staff sergeant because the commandant exerted undue command influence. The stuff at Parris Island, you see these incidents. If somebody stands up and says, I ain't doing that, I'm not doing that, and we're not doing that, none of these guys get dishonorable discharge or bad conduct discharge. Nobody goes to the brig. Nobody gets killed. No, none of that. Why do you think there's this reluctance when, and we're not talking about things being a little bit sideways. We're talking about things being, you know, straight up sideways, just not strong enough leaders, and that's how that happens? What do you make of that? Because let me just tell you, we haven't talked about it, and you need to come back, but Staff Sergeant Sanchez is not afraid to get sideways with people.
Yeah, you know, mostly I think it's a lack of moral courage. I think when you speak up too much, you tend to get punished. You know, I retired as a staff sergeant. There's some new sergeant majors that are running around the base today that when I was a sergeant, they were a corporal and they would follow me. And they're very deserving of being sergeant majors, first sergeants now. But in my experience, if one of your bosses was doing something wrong and I was just that type of Marine that I would speak out and say, hey, you know what? What's going on? Why is, you know, I'm the guy that questions stuff. You know, you tend to pay in your career. you tend to pay for questioning, you tend to pay for correcting someone from a higher rank. And I think some Marines get it. They get that, and they're like, I'm not even going to get involved. I'm not going to they don't want to pay with their rank or whatnot. I think the lack of moral courage keeps us where we're at, and we turn a blind eye, and, you know, we don't want to correct someone else. And I think it's a generational thing now. Dude. When I came in the 90s, the last corporals were correcting us. You know, the last corporal the last corporals weren't our friends. If you're a private POC, you kind of peers. Last corporals were on their own, and the corporals were on their own. They kind of got along with some of the sergeants, but I think that everybody tries to stay away from correcting each other now. Just simple things. I mean, I think it just starts with the simple things. Put your hands in your pocket, right?
Right.
I mean, and then it turns to big things like what we're talking about, you know, urinating on the enemy, drill instructors doing, that's not hazing in the eyes, you know, that's you're trying to break a Marine or a recruit. It's amazing that he's trying to, try to join the Marine Corps. I would think that he would have, with his family, he probably lost his family for joining the Marine Corps or right. trying to be a recruit.
No, he certainly comes from a different environment in which maybe not everybody in that family's perspective as, you know, as Muslim Americans, you know, is the Marine Corps perspective. And yet here you have this kid that joins the Marine Corps. And then what he gets called is he gets called a terrorist and that whole simulation of slitting somebody's throat and, you know, and all being put in the dryer until you say, I'm not a Muslim anymore. You know, here's another email. It's kind of interesting. Mac, you brought it up the other day that Gunner Sergeant Felix, who was just sentenced, is an air traffic controller. I'd be curious to hear what a staff NCO has to say about sometimes do those guys feel like they have to prove themselves because they don't come from the combat arms? Your thoughts on that, Stefan?
I think they do. I think, you know, we had a, you know, in my experience, you know, first lines, even sergeant majors, once you pick up staff, you could be, you know, from any other MOS, but then they come to the O3 field. And sometimes those are our biggest problems in the O3 field, because they don't understand the lingual that we have there, and sometimes they're intimidated, and I think they have to come in, they have to kind of prove something, that, hey, I don't mess around, this is who I am. But this is my thought. I think people get promoted, like we were talking before, they get promoted because of who they are. And if they were just to act the same, kind of normal, you know, we already know who they are by the ranks or whatnot.
Right.
I think they'll be successful. But when you have somebody out of the element and comes in and tries to screw the Marines over, then the Marines kind of lose respect. Or another thing is that, oh, you don't understand what all three guys go through. But in reality, that's just immaturity because we all kind of go through the same thing. We all are riflemen. So at the end of the night.
No, we're not. Come on. Don't hand me that.
No, well, what I'm talking about more in the sense of we know what Marine Corps life is.
Not but again, I would tell you, I don't know that I agree with the whole 9900 designation in that I've been in aviation supply all my life and now I'm going to go be a first sergeant in an infantry unit?
Yeah, it's a lot different. It's a lot different. I mean, I don't know if you remember our the captain that was with us. He was I still keep in touch with him. You know, he flies jets. I think he was a captain at the time.
The air officer?
Air officer, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And he was a lot different than the other officers.
Right.
Just because of where he comes from, his background. He was more relaxed. He was more like a person. You could speak to him more directly. So I felt that, yeah, there was a difference. There was a difference between both certain officers.
So you don't. So you say it's more the person than it is where they come from.
Yeah, I think the person who they are, you know, I don't think they deal with certain things like they deal in the grunt. So they're more relaxed. They're more approachable.
What are you saying? Grunts aren't approachable or relaxed? What's up with that?
Well, you know what?
What's up with that, Devil Dog? You know, when you come back, I've told this story before, but we're sitting there one night, and, you know, and there'd be nights when we would be, you know, we were doing all kinds of special operations stuff, trying to kill people that were running around, a guy named Zarqawi, and we had SEALs, and all, I mean, just all kinds of craziness at night. British, Australian guys, everybody coming in, blowing stuff up and leaving, and dogs killing people, and it was just, I mean, Fallujah, just crazy place. But one night, it's kind of slow, and so the Marines like, let's go around the room. One thing you like, one thing you hate. Right? And so, I can't remember, but he sat, he was one of the guys who dealt with the cop, the display, and his Lance Corporal by the name of Omar, and I can't remember his last name. But he's sitting there one night, and this is the stuff you go through, and next time you come on, we'll tell the whole story, but one thing I hate, and he's sitting there, and he's Hispanic, right? And he says, I hate Mexicans. And right? What was that? Like, all the white guys in the room, like, look at him, like, their eyebrows go down, like, what? And then he looks, he goes, no, dumbasses, we're not all Mexicans, okay? He's Colombian, he's Spanish, he's from Ecuador, right? And I'm from Honduras. And so he tells this story about being smuggled through Mexico and the federal police stealing his money. And he's 10 years old. And the coyote leaves him at a gas station in L.A. and says, hey, in the next 2 days, a woman will come here. That's your mom. And he doesn't even know his mom. And you're sitting there and you with all these Marines with all these different backgrounds. And so when you come back, I want to tell that story. And then the other story is the real stuff you deal with. I get a phone call from Kent Pendleton one night. Major McNamara, this is Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so. Hey, sir, what's up? I'm the 1MEF senior watch officer here at Kent Pendleton. Okay, why is he calling me? Yeah? Yes, sir. How can I help you? And he said, because normally if that guy's going to make contact with anybody, he's going to call the MEF in Iraq, not a regiment. So he says, do you have a sergeant by the name of, I can't remember the sergeant's name. And I said, yeah, he's sitting like 15 feet from me. And he said, well, he's told his girlfriend he's killing himself tonight. And I said, what? And he said, yep. And he tells me the story about another, you know, he wasn't supposed to go on this deployment. And another, you know, he came back home. He was only home for 3 months, and now he's gone again. He got his girl an engagement ring. He just got an email from a friend who saw his girl at a club with another Marine, blah, 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 blah. So I get off the phone. Okay. I get off the phone, and I look at Stefan Sanchez, and I tell him the story, and he looks at me and goes, oh, hell no. Suicide. Way too much paperwork. That didn't happen. That ain't happening tonight. I ain't having that. I said, well, we probably need to take care of his weapon and stuff. And so, but I would tell you this, being a good staff NCO in the Marine Corps, right? He was handled them with incredible kindness and gentleness, took him outside and spoke to him and then got him the help we need. I think we sent him home after that or whatnot, but no, when you go through all that stuff with people, and you become friends, and Staff Sergeant and I have been friends since 2006. So, first of all, thanks for doing this. I will I'll give you a call, and we'll bring you back on. I want to continue the leadership discussion about hazing and things like that because you have a different perspective certainly than I do.
Okay, sir. Good all right. Talking to you.
All right. What's left to do before you go to police academy?
Well, it's under. It's their turn to, you know, they gave me a letter, I guess an intent letter that they would like to hire me.
Nice.
So they I gotta go see the Wizards. I don't know if I'm going past that, you know.
You can fake. Hey, you can fake it.
I can fake it.
So you can fake
I gotta
it.
See that and my background investigation, and I think that's about it. I mean, but it's a long process. You know, I've been doing this since February.
Wow.
So at this point, I don't. It's on them. It's on their side. What happens next? I passed everything so far. So I guess it's just stay in shape, and hopefully get ready for the academy whenever they're ready.
All right. Well, they'll do the right thing. They'll hire you, and then we'll see you on TV. I'll be like, oh, that's Sanchez. What the hell? Look at that. You're supposed to look around to see if anybody's got a video camera before you start doing that stuff.
They asked me where I want to go. I said, well, I'm thinking about Venice Beach, like Bike Patrol or Dodger Stadium. And that's what they did. They laughed at me. They're like, no, man, you're going to Metro, South Central, probably East LA. That's where you're going.
What happened to Venice Bike Patrol, man? That's good.
They said, no, that's where you're going to say, okay. I guess, you know, you need me in the rough places, right?
All right. Well, first of all, again, thanks for doing this. And that's our James Sanchez from Roosevelt High School in East Los Angeles. No, I mean, honestly, as stories go in the Marine Corps, an awesome story of having good people in his life, his grandmother being instrumental amongst that, and then his devotion to his wife and his family is something, honestly, that you don't see often. And so he texted me yesterday, and I said, hey, man, you got to come on and talk. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, no problem, sir. Thank you for having me.
We'll do it again. We'll do it again. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, to you too, sir.
And happy birthday.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
There you have it, James Sanchez. Mike Musselman joins us next here on a Thursday edition. Honestly, that story is amazing. As I got to know him, you know, he and I are as different in terms of our background as the day is long. And just an awesome guy with a great story. And three kids, he and his wife, and doing good things. More of Almarine Radio coming up next.